A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I'm enjoying listening to your episode about the freedom to protest in democracies and the role of an opposition in democracy, and about how something you mentioned that really sparked my interest is if you look at anti-government groups and protesters, we can divide them between people who subscribe to the approach that a lot of the theorists of democracy that you mentioned in this podcast subscribe to, which was sort of a very constructive but within the system form of political movement might contest the results of an election without necessarily, but continuing to pledge allegiance to the state, let's say, viewing the government as the current manifestation of the state. And I see a sort of parallel here between that concept and the work of diplomatic missions, in which diplomatic missions are representing the state. They have to represent the government, but they represent the state across governments. And I think it's a useful construct because it allows us to think about the current government and the state in separate terms, whereas we naturally or instinctively tend to just view them as welded at the hip. The distinction that you mentioned, that we can divide protest and opposition along, pick up on something else you mentioned in that episode, which was that to be anti-democratic in Israel or to be an opponent of government, thinking that the current government is illegitimate, is a difficult position to maintain because of the fact that elections are free and fair, as you call them. And I think this is a good chance to talk about that concept of free and fair elections, because the fact that a political body holds elections isn't necessarily proof that the elections were actually a genuine contest or an opportunity for the electorate to express its will. And there's all sorts of avenues we could take to look into this. But we could begin maybe by talking about what that fundamentally means. When we hear about elections in autocratic regimes that are basically rigged, and sometimes we talk about in those types of regimes, sometimes we see monitoring being instituted in which international observers are brought in to ensure that the electoral process is, you know, watertight. And I'd love to talk about how that spectrum actually works. We can also include in our discussion electronic voting, which I know has sort of opened up a Pandora's box here of people who say that that sounds great, but it would be so hard to incorporate that into this auditing regime that it's just not worth it. But we do have some pretty extraordinary measures taken in democracies where the electoral process is generally considered to be highly robust to ensure that elections are real. And not only that elections are real, but that everybody who is able to vote gets to vote. We see it here in Israel, in which these mobile ballot boxes are brought out to the most remote places of the Negev desert, where there might be an outpost with just a few soldiers serving. Diplomatic missions overseas are able to vote. And that even brings with it probably a conversation best parked for a future episode about the insane logistics involved in that type of thing, and the freedom to vote. There is a movement in many democracies where people, you know, think that expats should have retained the right to vote, but that's not the course that Israel takes. But I think we can maybe keep those topics for our next discussion about how elections work. Today, let's focus upon the rigor of elections themselves. What do we mean specifically when we say that an election is robust and fair? And when we see how fake elections take place, what are some typical indicators, subtle and not so subtle, that it's not a legitimate electoral process?
Daniel sent us this one after listening to our episode on protest and opposition in democracies. He wants to dig into what we actually mean when we say an election is free and fair. What makes the difference between a genuine contest and a rigged one? And what the telltale signs are when you're looking at a process that's basically theatre? And he mentions something interesting I want to get to. This idea that we can distinguish between the state and the current government, the way diplomatic missions do. That's worth unpacking.
Before we dive in, quick note, DeepSeek V4 Pro is generating our script today, which means if anything comes out particularly brilliant, I'm taking credit anyway.
That's how the division of labor works around here.
Let's start with that distinction Daniel raised, because it's actually the conceptual foundation for everything else we're going to talk about. The state versus the government. Most people use those terms interchangeably, and that sloppiness matters.
And Daniel's parallel to diplomatic missions is sharp. An ambassador represents the state, the continuous legal and political entity, not whichever party happens to hold power at the moment. They serve across administrations. The embassy doesn't change its fundamental mission when the government changes.
And that's exactly the framework that makes constructive opposition possible. You can oppose the government vigorously, relentlessly, while still pledging allegiance to the state. You're not trying to burn the whole thing down. You're saying the current manifestation is wrong, and you want to replace it through the mechanisms the state provides.
Which brings us to elections. Because elections are the mechanism, that's the bridge between opposition and governance. And if the bridge is fake, the whole system collapses.
Let's define terms first, because free and fair gets thrown around like it's obvious, and it's not. When election monitors and political scientists use that phrase, they're referring to a pretty specific set of criteria that have been codified over decades.
Give me the framework. What's the checklist?
The foundational document is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 21, which says the will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of government, and that will shall be expressed in periodic and genuine elections. But that's broad. The real operational standards come from things like the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and then monitoring organizations like the Carter Center and the National Democratic Institute have built detailed assessment frameworks on top of that.
What are they actually looking at when they go into a country?
They break it down into several categories. First, the legal framework. Is the election law itself fair? Does it guarantee universal suffrage, or does it exclude certain groups? Are the rules for candidate registration transparent, or can the incumbent government arbitrarily disqualify opponents?
That last one is huge. If you can just knock your strongest challenger off the ballot on some technicality, you haven't really held an election.
And that's one of the subtler forms of rigging. It doesn't look like ballot stuffing. It looks like a court ruling 3 weeks before election day that the main opposition candidate's paperwork was incomplete.
Or that they have a criminal conviction that just happened to be handed down right before the campaign season.
So legal framework is the first bucket. Then you've got the electoral system itself. Is it designed to produce genuinely representative outcomes, or is it gerrymandered into absurdity? Are district boundaries drawn by an independent commission or by the ruling party?
We see variations on this everywhere, including in established democracies. Redistricting fights in the United States are basically a slow-motion battle over how much an election can be shaped before anyone casts a vote.
That's an important point. The spectrum isn't perfect democracy on one end and complete sham on the other. Even countries with long democratic traditions have weaknesses in their electoral processes. The question is whether those weaknesses are severe enough to undermine the legitimacy of the outcome.
What's the next bucket?
Voter registration and the franchise. Are eligible voters systematically excluded? Are there barriers to registration that disproportionately affect certain communities? And conversely, are there phantom voters on the rolls?
Phantom voters being people who don't exist, or who are dead, or who are registered in multiple places.
In some of the more transparently rigged elections, you'll see voter rolls that exceed the adult population of a district. That's not subtle.
No, that's just math. If your district has 100,000 adults and 120,000 registered voters, someone's not even trying.
Then there's candidate and campaign rights. Can opposition candidates actually campaign? Do they have access to media? Are they free from harassment, arrest, violence? This is where a lot of regimes show their hand. The election law on paper might look fine, but if opposition rallies are broken up by police, or if state media gives the incumbent 95% of coverage, you don't have a level playing field.
Social media has complicated this. You can have a regime that doesn't control traditional media directly, but runs enormous bot networks and disinformation campaigns to drown out opponents.
That's a whole other episode. But yeah, the media environment is part of the assessment. Monitors look at whether state resources are being used for campaign purposes, whether there's a distinction between the ruling party and the government itself. When the incumbent shows up to inaugurate a new highway during the campaign, and it's covered as a government event rather than a campaign event, that's a red flag.
Which connects back to Daniel's point about the state versus the government. In a healthy system, the government doesn't get to use the state's resources for party purposes. The line is clear and enforced. In a rigged system, that line doesn't exist.
The next big category is the voting process itself. Is the ballot secret? Are there procedures to prevent multiple voting? Are polling places accessible? And critically, are there domestic and international observers with meaningful access?
Meaningful access being the key phrase. Some regimes will allow observers but restrict them to certain regions, or deny them access to the counting process, or accredit them so late they can't actually do their jobs.
The Carter Center has written extensively about this. They won't even deploy a full observation mission unless they get access to all phases of the process: registration, campaigning, voting, counting, tabulation, and the post-election dispute resolution. If a government says you can watch people vote but you can't watch them count, that tells you something.
What about the counting and tabulation phase specifically? That seems like the most vulnerable point.
It absolutely is. And this is where electronic voting becomes relevant, because Daniel mentioned it. The counting phase is where fraud is hardest to detect if proper safeguards aren't in place. In a paper ballot system, you have a physical record. You can recount, you can audit. You can compare the number of ballots cast to the number of voters who signed in.
With electronic voting, you're trusting the machine.
You're trusting the machine, and you're trusting that the machine's software hasn't been tampered with. And you're trusting that the machine's output accurately reflects the inputs. And you're often doing all of this without a voter, verified paper trail.
This is the Pandora's box Daniel mentioned. Electronic voting sounds modern and efficient, but it creates audit nightmares.
There's a reason that countries with strong electoral integrity, Germany for example, have been extremely cautious about electronic voting. Germany's constitutional court actually ruled in 2009 that electronic voting machines without a paper trail were unconstitutional, because voters have a right to verify that their vote was recorded correctly, and the public has a right to verify the count.
That's fascinating. The court basically said transparency isn't optional. You can't have a system where the inner workings are opaque to the citizen.
And think about the contrast. In a paper ballot system, you have representatives from multiple parties watching the count at every polling station. You have a chain of custody for ballot boxes. You have reconciliation procedures. If the number of ballots doesn't match the number of voters who signed the register, that's flagged immediately.
That's exactly what Daniel was describing with Israel's system. Mobile ballot boxes going out to remote desert outposts, diplomatic missions voting overseas. The logistics are enormous, but the principle is that every eligible voter gets a chance, and every vote is accounted for through a transparent process.
Israel's actually an interesting case study because of those logistics. You've got soldiers in isolated positions, you've got diplomatic staff on different continents, you've got prisoners who retain voting rights. The Central Elections Committee deploys what they call double envelope ballots for these special populations. The outer envelope has the voter's identifying information, which is verified before the inner envelope with the actual ballot is separated and counted.
You get both verification of eligibility and secrecy of the vote. That's the balance.
And it's a physical, auditable process. Every step leaves a paper trail. If there's a dispute, you can go back and examine the envelopes, the registers, the protocols.
Which brings us to the other end of the spectrum. Let's talk about what a rigged election actually looks like, beyond the cartoon version of soldiers herding people to the polls at gunpoint.
The most sophisticated electoral autocracies have gotten very good at producing elections that look plausible on the surface while guaranteeing the outcome. Political scientists call this electoral authoritarianism or competitive authoritarianism. The key feature is that formal democratic institutions exist and are taken seriously by the regime, not as a genuine contest, but as a tool for legitimization and co-option.
They hold elections because elections confer a kind of legitimacy that simply declaring yourself president for life doesn't.
And they've learned that outright 100% of the vote results make them look ridiculous. So they allow some opposition, they allow some criticism, they might even allow opposition parties to win some parliamentary seats. But the system is tilted so heavily that the incumbent can't lose the presidency.
What are the specific tilt mechanisms?
Let's go through them. First, control of the electoral administration. In a genuine democracy, the Electoral Commission is independent. Its members might be appointed by different branches of government, or require supermajority legislative approval, or include opposition representatives. In an electoral autocracy, the commission answers to the incumbent.
That means they control voter registration, candidate registration, polling place locations, the count, the announcement of results.
Second, control of media. This doesn't necessarily mean state ownership of all outlets, though that's one model. It can mean regulatory pressure on independent media, selective tax audits, denial of advertising revenue from state-owned enterprises, or simply the fact that state television reaches 90% of the population while opposition outlets are online only.
State television coverage of the incumbent is constant, opening hospitals, meeting foreign leaders, being presidential, while coverage of opponents is either non-existent or relentlessly negative.
Third, abuse of state resources. The incumbent's campaign is effectively funded by the state. Government vehicles, government staff, government events all blur into the campaign. There's a term for this, administrative resource. It's the incumbent's ability to use the levers of government to reward supporters and punish opponents.
It's hard to police because the line between governing and campaigning is blurry. If the president announces a new subsidy program 2 weeks before the election, is that governing or campaigning?
Fourth, manipulation of the legal system. Opposition candidates face selective prosecution. They're convicted on charges that may or may not be politically motivated, but the timing is always convenient. Or they're not prosecuted. They're just tied up in investigations that prevent them from campaigning effectively.
Russia's a classic case of this, but it's not just Russia. You see variations across many countries where the opposition leader is perpetually under investigation for something.
Fifth, manipulation of the economy. Incumbents time economic goodies. Wage increases for public sector workers, subsidy expansions, tax breaks, to land right before elections. And they can also create economic pain for opposition strongholds.
You get a cycle where the economy appears to boom in election years and contract afterward. Voters notice the pattern eventually, but by then the election's over.
Sixth, and this is one of the more sophisticated techniques, manipulation of the electoral system itself. Not fraud in the counting, but design choices that predetermine outcomes. Gerrymandering we mentioned, but also things like changing the electoral system from proportional representation to first past the post when that favors the incumbent. Or altering the threshold for parliamentary representation to exclude smaller opposition parties.
Or changing term limits, then changing them back, then changing them again. We've seen that playbook.
Seventh, and this is the most direct, manipulation of the vote itself. Ballot stuffing, multiple voting, intimidation at polling stations, falsification of result sheets. In the most egregious cases, the announced results simply don't match what observers recorded at polling stations.
This is where parallel vote tabulation comes in, right? Observers collect their own results from a statistically significant sample of polling stations and compare them to the official count.
Parallel vote tabulation, or PVT, is one of the most powerful tools for detecting fraud. If the official results diverge significantly from the observer sample, you got evidence of manipulation. This was used very effectively in Ukraine in 2004 after the Orange Revolution and in various African elections. But it only works if observers have genuine access and a large enough sample.
If the regime doesn't just kick the observers out when the results start looking inconvenient.
So those are the mechanisms. But let's step back and talk about what international observation missions actually do, because Daniel asked about the monitoring process specifically.
Yeah, how does that work in practice? Who sends these observers, and what are they actually looking for?
There are several major organizations. The Carter Center, founded by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, has observed more than 100 elections in 39 countries. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the O, runs observation missions through its Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights. The European Union deploys election observation missions. The African Union has its own observation framework. and there are domestic observer groups in many countries which often have the deepest understanding of local conditions.
What's the difference between a short-term and a long-term observation mission?
Long-term observers deploy months before the election and stay through the post-election period. They're watching the entire process, the legal framework, the registration, the campaign environment, the media landscape. Short-term observers typically arrive just before Election Day and focus on the voting and counting process. You need both. If you only watch Election Day, you miss all the manipulation that happened in the months leading up to it.
The monitoring isn't just about catching ballot box fraud. It's about assessing whether the whole environment allows for a genuine contest.
And the observers produce detailed reports with specific findings and recommendations. These reports matter because they can affect international legitimacy, foreign aid, sanctions, investment decisions. Governments that want to be seen as legitimate care about these assessments, even if they push back against them publicly.
There's a critique of election observation that's worth airing. Critics say it can legitimize flawed elections by giving them a veneer of international approval. If observers show up, watch a process that's fundamentally tilted, and then issue a statement that's carefully diplomatic rather than calling it what it is, the regime gets to say, international observers were here and certified our election.
That's a real tension. Observation missions have to navigate between being so critical that they get expelled and not invited back, and being so diplomatic that they whitewash serious problems. The Carter Center has been pretty good about walking that line. They've refused to observe elections that they considered clearly illegitimate, because showing up would just provide cover.
Sometimes they've observed, but then issued reports that were devastating.
The point is that observation isn't a rubber stamp, or at least it shouldn't be. The quality of the observation mission matters enormously. Who's running it, what their methodology is, whether they have genuine access, whether they're willing to speak plainly about what they find.
Let's talk about some concrete examples of elections that were clearly not free and fair, and what the specific indicators were. Not the cartoonish ones, but the ones that require a closer look.
Take Russia's 2018 presidential election. On the surface, there were multiple candidates on the ballot. Putin won with about 77% of the vote. But let's look at the indicators. Alexei Navalny, the most prominent opposition figure, was barred from running due to a criminal conviction that was widely viewed as politically motivated. State media coverage was overwhelmingly pro-Putin. There were credible reports of forced voting, state employees being pressured to vote, and to show proof they'd voted. And the Election Commission was entirely controlled by the Kremlin.
The ballot had other names on it, but the outcome was never in doubt. The election wasn't a contest. It was a performance of a contest.
And that's a key distinction. In a genuine election, the outcome is uncertain. The incumbent might lose. In an electoral autocracy, the outcome is predetermined, but the regime goes through the motions to maintain the appearance of democratic legitimacy.
What about Venezuela? That's been a prominent case in recent years.
Venezuela's been a slow-motion erosion. The 2018 presidential election had many of the classic indicators. The opposition was fragmented, with key figures barred from running or imprisoned. The election was moved to an earlier date to catch the opposition off guard. The Electoral Commission was controlled by the government. State media was a propaganda machine. And there were widespread reports of voters being pressured through the Carnet de la Patria, a government-issued identity card that was linked to food distribution. The implicit message was, vote for the government or lose access to subsidized food.
That's a particularly coercive mechanism. It's not a soldier at the polling station. It's the threat of hunger.
That's why the framework for assessing elections has to look at the entire environment, not just what happens on election day. If voters are making their choice under conditions of economic coercion, that's not a free election, even if the ballot is secret and the count is accurate.
Let's pivot to something Daniel raised that's more subtle. He mentioned that the fact that a political body holds elections isn't necessarily proof that the elections were a genuine contest. And he's right. What are some of the less obvious indicators that an election is problematic?
One is the playing field concept. Even if the formal rules are neutral, the actual conditions of competition can be so skewed that there's no genuine contest. This shows up in campaign finance. If the incumbent can outspend the opposition by a factor of 10 or 100, and there are no effective limits or disclosure requirements, that's a tilted field.
That's relevant even in established democracies. The role of money in politics is a perennial concern precisely because it can undermine the fairness of elections without technically breaking any laws.
Another subtle indicator is the timing of elections. In parliamentary systems, the incumbent often has the power to call elections at a moment of their choosing. If they call a snap election specifically to catch the opposition unprepared, that's not illegal, but it raises questions about the fairness of the contest.
What about the disqualification of candidates through ostensibly legal means? We touched on this earlier, but it's worth exploring.
This is one of the most common techniques in what scholars call competitive authoritarian regimes. The law requires candidates to meet certain criteria: residency, age, citizenship, no criminal record. Those criteria can be applied neutrally, or they can be weaponized. The opposition leader suddenly faces a criminal investigation for something that happened years ago, or their residency is challenged on a technicality, or the signatures they submitted to qualify for the ballot are invalidated for minor errors.
The key is that there's an independent judiciary, or there isn't. If the courts are controlled by the incumbent, legal challenges to opposition candidates will succeed, and legal challenges to the incumbent's eligibility will fail.
The independence of the judiciary is actually one of the most important preconditions for free and fair elections, because so many electoral disputes end up in court. If the courts aren't independent, the entire dispute resolution mechanism is compromised.
If you're trying to assess whether an election in a particular country is legitimate, one of the first things you'd look at is who controls the courts,
who controls the Electoral Commission, and who controls the media regulator, and who controls the security forces. The institutional landscape matters enormously.
Let's talk about electronic voting more specifically, since Daniel raised it. What's the actual state of play globally?
It's a mixed picture. Some countries have embraced electronic voting. Brazil and India are the two biggest examples. Others have tried it and backed away. The Netherlands abandoned electronic voting in 2007 after researchers demonstrated that the machines could be compromised. Germany's constitutional court ruling I mentioned earlier effectively ended electronic voting there. Ireland scrapped a planned system after concerns about verifiability.
The core concern is the same everywhere. How do you audit a system where the vote exists only as an electronic record?
The gold standard in election security is the Voter Verified Paper Audit Trail, or VVPAT. The idea is that the voting machine produces a paper record that the voter can verify before it's deposited in a ballot box. If there's a dispute, you can recount the paper ballots and compare them to the electronic tally. India's system works this way. The electronic voting machine prints a paper slip that the voter can see through a glass window for a few seconds before it drops into a sealed box.
You get the efficiency of electronic counting with the auditability of paper.
In practice, India's system has been criticized because the paper trail is only visible for a few seconds and random audits are limited. The Supreme Court of India has weighed in on this multiple times, and there's an ongoing debate about what percentage of VVPAT slips should be counted against the electronic results.
What about internet voting? That's the real frontier.
Internet voting is a security nightmare. Estonia is the only country that uses it broadly for national elections, and even there, it's been heavily criticized by security researchers. The fundamental problem is that you can't guarantee the integrity of the voter's device. If someone's computer is compromised, their vote can be altered without their knowledge. And you can't do a meaningful recount because there's no physical record.
The convenience of voting from your phone comes at the cost of verifiability.
That's the trade-off that most democracies have decided isn't worth making. Department of Homeland Security has consistently advised against internet voting for high-stakes elections. The consensus among election security experts is that internet voting introduces risks that can't be adequately mitigated with current technology.
Which brings us back to the physical, labor-intensive processes that Daniel described. Mobile ballot boxes in the desert, diplomatic voting overseas. Those are expensive and logistically complex, but they're verifiable.
That's the point. Electoral integrity isn't free. It requires investment in logistics, in security, in training, in observation. Countries that take elections seriously spend real money and real effort on making sure the process works. Countries that are just going through the motions cut corners, and those cut corners are often visible if you know where to look.
Let's talk about some positive examples. What does a robust electoral system look like in practice?
There's no single model, but you can identify common features. Independent electoral administration. Universal suffrage with minimal barriers to registration. Transparent campaign finance. Balanced media coverage, whether through regulation or public broadcasting norms. Meaningful observation by domestic and international monitors. A paper-based voting system with rigorous chain of custody procedures. Counting processes that are observed by representatives of multiple parties. And an independent judiciary to resolve disputes.
All of this happens in public view. That's the through line. Secrecy is the enemy of electoral integrity.
Every step of the process should be observable by the public, by party representatives, by monitors. If a government says, trust us, the machines are secure but won't let anyone examine the software, that's not a trustworthy process.
There's a principle in election administration called public confidence. It's not enough for an election to be technically fair. It has to be perceived as fair by the public. If large segments of the population believe the process is rigged, you've got a legitimacy crisis, even if everything was actually above board.
That's why transparency matters so much. You can't just assert that the election was clean. You have to demonstrate it in ways that skeptics can verify for themselves.
Which connects back to what Daniel was saying about Israel's elections. The mobile ballot boxes, the double envelope system, the party representatives at every polling station. These aren't just procedural quirks. They're mechanisms for building public confidence. When every party has observers at the count, it's much harder for anyone to credibly claim the election was stolen.
And Israel's Central Elections Committee publishes extremely detailed results, down to individual polling stations. Anyone can download the data and analyze it. That kind of transparency is a hallmark of a system that's designed to be auditable.
Let's circle back to the state versus government distinction, because I think it ties everything together. Daniel's insight was that diplomatic missions represent the state across governments, and that this is a useful framework for thinking about how opposition can be loyal to the state while opposing the government.
Elections are the mechanism that connects the two. The state provides the framework. The constitution, the legal system, the electoral infrastructure. The government is the temporary occupant of the state's institutions, chosen through elections and removable through elections. If the elections are genuine, the government's legitimacy flows from the consent of the governed. If the elections are rigged, that chain is broken.
That's why electoral integrity isn't just a technical question. It's the foundation of the entire democratic edifice. If people don't believe that elections are a genuine mechanism for changing the government, then opposition becomes resistance, becomes something much more destabilizing.
Because if the ballot box is closed, what's left?
And that's the dynamic we were talking about in the episode Daniel referenced. When people believe the system is rigged, they stop playing by the system's rules. That's how democracies unravel.
There's a concept in political science called loser's consent. The idea is that in a functioning democracy, the losing side accepts the result and continues to participate in the system. They consent to be governed by the winners because they believe they'll have a fair chance to become the winners next time. That consent is entirely dependent on the perception that the election was fair.
If that perception erodes, loser's consent evaporates. You get what we've seen in various countries. The losing side refuses to concede, claims fraud, and takes to the streets. Sometimes those claims are baseless, sometimes they're not. But the damage to the system is real either way.
Which is why election administration has to be demonstrably clean. You can't just be clean, you have to be visibly clean. Every procedure, every safeguard, every audit has to be public and verifiable.
If you're a citizen trying to assess whether an election in your country or another country is legitimate, what's your checklist? What should you be looking at?
I'd start with a few key questions. 1. Who runs the election? Is the Electoral Commission independent, or does it answer to the incumbent? 2. Can the opposition campaign freely? Are candidates able to register, hold rallies, access media without harassment? 3. Is the media environment balanced, or does state media function as a propaganda arm of the government? 4. Is there a paper trail? Can the results be audited independently? 5. Are there observers with genuine access to all phases of the process? 6. Can disputes be resolved by an independent judiciary?
That's a solid framework. And the more no answers you get, the more likely you're looking at an electoral autocracy rather than a genuine democracy.
Even in established democracies, these are questions worth asking continuously. Democratic institutions aren't self-maintaining. They require vigilance. The moment you stop scrutinizing the process is the moment it starts to decay.
That's where we should leave it, I think. The question isn't just whether an election meets some abstract standard of free and fair. It's whether the entire ecosystem, the institutions, the norms, the legal framework, the media, the judiciary, supports genuine competition for power. Elections don't happen in a vacuum. They're embedded in a political system, and the health of that system determines whether the elections are meaningful or just theater.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The wood frog can survive being frozen solid for up to 7 months. Its heart stops beating, its blood stops flowing, and up to 70% of its body water turns to ice. When spring arrives, it thaws out and hops away.
The next time you think your morning commute is rough, remember the wood frog spends half the year as a popsicle and gets on with its day. This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show.
We'll be back soon. Until then, stay curious.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.